Hi, everybody. My name's Tom Scott. I'm joined, as always, by RP Eddy. RP, thanks for being here. Today, I want to thank Danny Meyer for being here. Danny is somebody I've known of and have met or met many years ago. He's been a, you know, among the sort of entrepreneur world, he's sort of a beacon, somebody who's, you know, really been in the mix for a long time. And somebody who gets us all to think. So I know a busy person too. So I appreciate you taking the time to be here. There was a guy we were recruiting at Nantucket Nectars. I don't remember the year, but early days, someone to be the president. And he took us to dinner at the Union Square Cafe. And we were just like, wow, we didn't even know that there were restaurants that were that nice, you know, at the time. And he took the job, by the way. He, within like a month, he'd been hired away to become the new CEO of Snapple. But he was the one who had chosen the dinner. Anyway, and so so I knew of Danny a long time ago. And then there was this story, Danny, and I have, you know, the letter here, that these friends and I used to do this annual dinner there. Do you recall this?
Yeah, wasn't it also Gramercy Tavern?
That was Gramercy Tavern, yeah.
Okay, that
was
Gramercy I remember that.
Yeah. So we would do this thing on December the 20th. We had this one friend who became this very senior person at Goldman Sachs at age 27, like very young. And he was he's like a brilliant guy. And he quit to become a drifter, let's say. And he said, I want to meet everyone for dinner before I go. And so we went to Gramercy Tavern, December 20th, I think it was 1993. And then we did it for another 20 years thereafter. We would go every year and you used to greet us and then my friend Sean Moran wrote this very long, very heartfelt note. I just read it and I won't bore everybody, but anyway, and it was like this relationship developed that went, and I think we stopped doing it like in 2013 or so, because I think kids would be the real answer as to why we stopped.
I thought you were going to say the prices got too damn high.
No, no. But here's the thing I will tell you is that the service was amazing. In this case, I got engaged in South Africa, and I had sent gifts to everybody from South Africa through the restaurant. And then the restaurant like created like some pomp and circumstance around it. And this letter sort of relates to that. So anyway, people are probably bored by this. Here's the reason I bring it up. Great customer service. Like he was really good at knowing who we were and being a part of us. And if you recall, and I made, you know, the Gramercy Tavern was and is sort of this, I don't want to say fancy, but it's kind of fancy, but exalted. How's that word? It's sort of an exalted place. So anyway,
I think it's comfy. It hits this amazing note of going out and coming home. You know, went out, but you also feel like you came home.
Thank you for that. Because fancy is the wrong word. Fancy is the wrong word. It's nice.
Refined.
Sure. Well, here's what I like. I want to be relaxed. I just want to be relaxed wherever I go. And sometimes fancy makes me very unrelaxed. And I was always relaxed there. So that's why that's how I think of fancy. So Danny, RP and I have been having conversations here for a month or more now. And RP's background was such that he really saw this coming and really knew what was coming and all the implications that come along with it. And, you know, among the things we've looked at are, it's vast to begin with. There's just a vast number of issues that come into play. One of the things I know about you and RP, you know, feel free to jump in at any time. You actually sniffed this out pretty early. You know, you were taking action earlier than most. Do you see it that way? And if you do, why, how, like why was your nose on this so early on in the game?
I think, number one, I'm a voracious reader but there was another thing that, as I think about your question, I had two trips planned, one of which was actually to go to China, and I had never been to China before, and the other trip was to go to Italy, and where I've been at least 50 or 60 times in my life. The trip to Italy was scheduled for March the 14th. And the trip to China, I believe, would have been scheduled for a few weeks before that. And so I had been following this news very, very carefully. And if you think about it, those are the two countries, first of all, obviously originating in China, but I think Italy was the next country that we kept hearing about where this had hit really, really hard. So probably for that reason, I was following the news a little bit more carefully maybe than some other people were, because each day I wondered, would I have to cancel those trips, which obviously I figured out early on I would have to cancel those trips. And that was before people in New York were really thinking about it. Then this other thing happened, which is that on March the 3rd, we hosted an annual breakfast at the Modern, our restaurant in Midtown, for people in the transportation industry in New York City. And it was reported the following Monday that one of the attendees at that Thursday, that previous Thursday morning breakfast, had tested positive for the virus, which was the first time I had heard of a New Yorker, certainly, and this was a prominent member of the transportation industry. And we closed the restaurant because I was just afraid. I did not want to put anyone in harm's way. Mm. And so we closed it just for a day. We scrubbed, we did all this kind of stuff. And it was that very day, that same Monday, that we got a similar type of scare where one of our cooks at Union Square Cafe had been sent home with flu-like symptoms. And we did the right thing to send him home, but we also, you know, during the next day and a half, which was exactly how long it took to both get a test and get results, we closed the restaurant. We later learned that he had tested negative, but it didn't matter. We had now thrown out all the food. And so we were, I just think, acutely experiencing this and learning about this perhaps earlier than others had. That doesn't make us any smarter. It just means that there came a point when it just became clear to me that those two circumstances were just going to repeat themselves. And it was awkward because each time it happened, we went through the whole crisis communication mode with our staff, with our guests. And it just felt like, look, everyone we spoke to said, trust us. Everyone we spoke to who had any kind of scientific knowledge of this virus throughout the world said, trust us, this is going to get way worse in New York. A lot of people didn't believe it. Yeah. As a matter of fact, there were restaurants serving food in their restaurants throughout the weekend of March 15th, March 14th, 15th, March 16th. And I guess it was about March 17th or so that New York finally said no more gathering in restaurants. Yeah. But the other thing, just, you know, you saw major industries, and I'll start with the sports industry, who were making these decisions early. And it just seemed like, you know, that sports rely upon people gathering. So do restaurants. So we just took our cues from elsewhere. I don't want to portray us as really being all that smart.
Well, RP, I know RP was smart, you know, and I remember saying to him early on how I felt it was a lack of humility on my part that had me come to the game when I came. And I came to the game the night after I heard about Tom Hanks. I got a note from a friend who was in Italy, and in it she described the situation, and it really shocked me. And then I heard the Tom Hanks news. And then that morning we canceled work. I think it was the 12th. And then when RP and I started talking, because he had built this plan in the mid 90s, early 90s for this purpose, to fight something exactly like this, what he explained to me, and RP, you know, feel free to jump in, but that these exponential threats are not that easy to understand. Like this is, we are not set up to understand these things intuitively in a way that is as helpful as it can be. And RP, I don't know if I described that properly.
Yeah, I mean, on no metric, Danny, nice to meet you. On no metric did this fit anything we're good at understanding, right? So we had exponential growth. That's not part of how our brain is wired. we had nothing in our collective consciousness or unconsciousness. Last time this happened, America was 100 years ago, totally different world, totally different country. Of note, 100 years ago, when this did happen in America, we just came out of World War I. It wasn't really even a headline story for that long. America looked at it so differently. So, you know, we come to this pretty de novo. And so then you have this complexity of the science plus the economy, economics aspects, plus sociology aspects, plus in your instance, Danny, like, you know, all the small business, large business, it was a lot to put together. What's it mean for me? Became really hard for people. Some places got it better than others. So you got it early, but our country didn't get it early.
Yeah, one thing that, you know, to your point, RJ, I would say that we are used to trying to wrap our minds around disasters that happened to someone else, or maybe even us, like in the case of 9/11. But when you think about hurricanes and tsunamis and earthquakes, or, you know, Ebola even, you think that happened somewhere else. And I don't think that we are really wired to say, wait, this is happening to all of us. And so when we read about things that were happening far, far away from us, you know, I'll never forget the week that you started reading about Fashion Week shutting down in Milan. And, you know, some of the big festivals in Verona and Venice shutting down, that started to feel like, wait a second, China is not really that close to Italy. This thing is real. And, you know, I had also attended a talk probably about 2 or 3 weeks earlier than this by Tom Friedman from the New York Times, who, as you probably know, has a theory that acceleration is really, you know, the story of our day. Is he basically feels that, you know, you had the wheel, then you had the printing press, then you had the Industrial Revolution, and now what you basically have is the power of computing that has magnified the age of acceleration, where every single thing that we're dealing with is going to be happening so much more quickly than our brains are possibly able to contemplate. And having attended that talk just like 2 weeks before all of this hit us, or hit our restaurants and making these decisions, I actually applied some of that logic to the thinking too, which is, don't slow down, go faster, because this thing is going to go very quickly.
A lot of what we're just talking about is just being aware of our cognitive weaknesses, and that the wet computer between our ears, which is 150,000 years old, is just bad at some things. And if you can be good at knowing, you're bad at lots of things. Sometimes you're not quite as bad at those things. That reality, that awareness allows us to, you know, once in a while, maybe dodge a oncoming freight train.
True, but you're so right about that. It reminds me of Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, and I was walking our then 5-year-old daughter to her first day of nursery school, and I remember very, very well saying, as we were approaching the school on Fifth Avenue in Lower Manhattan, oh my gosh, honey, listen to that loud airplane over our head. There was a really freaking loud airplane sound. And I didn't look up, and it never, ever dawned on my cognitive ability what possibly was about to happen. So much so that 20 minutes later, after I was leaving drop-off, and then I went up to go get some money out of an ATM, and as I'm getting money out of the ATM, a woman runs into the bank saying, oh my gosh, a little airplane just hit the World Trade Center. And I walked outside calmly, and I looked up, and my assumption was I could see I could see that something had hit the World Trade Center. My assumption was that a little private jet or private plane had hit the World Trade Center. I didn't know that it was the second one. I didn't know it was a jetliner. I didn't know that the thing, I still didn't understand that the thing I had heard 20 minutes earlier was a human being flying into a building. So it's a long way of saying I completely agree with you that until you experience something that you never put together or contemplated, then you just don't think. You just don't think this could actually be that.
And you were using, at that moment on that Tuesday, accurate pattern recognition. An airplane had flown into, I think, the Empire State Building in the 50s. And that you may remember that story somehow, I read about it. That's the last thing we kind of knew that was like that. And it was a small plane. And nothing like that had ever happened before. But it's when you, as you were talking about, hey, I'm on my way to China. Hey, I'm on my way to Italy. That we begin to pay attention to these things. And I suspect for most of us, the outbreak of a disease in far-flung foreign China was a lot less poignant than it in Italy, right? A place that we can feel a little more familiar with. So it's when those statistics and those news become stories.
Yes. That said, you know, you're just reminding me of another thing, which is that one of my colleagues, actually three of my colleagues from Shake Shack had been in China, I believe at the end of January. And they had reported to me as well that, and they were there, I think, just the week that this was being spoken about. In China for the first time. And they left China to head to Tokyo. And they thought it odd that before crossing the border, they had to have their temperatures taken with a laser thermometer. And when they got back to the US at the very end of January, I remember that the three of them self-quarantined, which is a term I had never heard of before. So
good for them.
It's just reminding me that I think that because of those kind of stories, maybe we had a little bit of a leg up that this was the real deal.
Yeah.
You know, Danny, when I think about your world, so Danny is, you know, Shake Shack, many restaurants. He's a restaurateur. I mean, you are primarily, I don't know the exact numbers, but you are primarily a person who builds businesses based on close gathering, you know? Yeah, there's food. I'm sure you're doing takeout at certain places, or you can do takeout at certain places. But generally speaking, that's not the business you built. You built a different business. And I just want to say, like, I'm rooting for you big time, you know? And I would imagine most of us are rooting for you. You know, if not specifically, generally, I think when restaurants are in a position to serve as many people as possible, that says a lot about where our culture is going to go. I would also just argue it's going to be I'm in the live events business, so I'm very sympathetic to some of your challenges. You know, as RP's heard, and I'm beating this dead horse, but I want my children to go to camp this summer because I think it's good for them. And we, as parents, we have a group of us parents are working with the head of the camp to find a solution, knowing that on June 1st, we might all say, we got to turn back. It's not going to work. We're going to give it everything we can to attempt to make this work. And in a similar vein, I would say that at a minimum, spiritually, we are rooting for people like you to be in a position to serve as many as possible, because it'll say a lot about the progress that we've made. I felt like one of the things that would be constructive is, to the extent we could talk about how you're thinking about those things. I'm sure you have more questions than answers, but I know you're doing work for the state of New York in this regard. Give us just a general sense of where you are, and maybe we can get more into the specifics of where you think we can go.
I've actually been trying to learn as much as possible about what it's going to take for us to safely bring our employees back to work. I should just say that in our independent restaurants in New York, which is Union Square Hospitality Group, places like Union Square Cafe and Gramercy Tavern, The Modern, Maialino, and I could name a few others. We are not in business right now. We're not doing takeout. We're not doing curbside pickup. We'd like to get into that. But unfortunately, along the way, we've lost some colleagues and many of our colleagues have lost people in their family. And it just, you know, New York is a different, New York has sadly been the capital of you know, the numbers of real, not only people infected with the virus, but also people who have died from it. And it's hit home. And so for that reason, if we put survival first and we say, you know, at first do no harm, it's been hard for me to get to the point of saying now it's safe to bring people back to work. So that's what I'm focused on right now. And when operators in our company, and we're now down out of 2,400 employees that we had on March 13th, we now are down to 75. So that's a 35-year-old business that we have had to dismantle. And it's not fun. It's sad. It's hard. But what we're thinking about right now is what are the building blocks to getting open. As far as I'm concerned, it's really three. Figure out the safety protocol to bring as few people back to work as possible that actually get us to the starting gate. Because I think if the notion is opening your restaurant, and we think that an open restaurant feels like the Gramercy Tavern that you would go to every year on December the 20th. Or an open restaurant feels like whatever your favorite restaurant or bar is, wherever you happen to live, where people are shoulder to shoulder and, you know, the servers are joking with their tables and, you know, pouring bottles of wine and clearing plates and balancing trays of cocktails. That's going to be a long time. And it's going to be a long time because it's going to be a long time before not only is it safe to bring back people back to work, but it's also safe and guests feel confident and secure in being out in public to the degree that they once were. So by our focusing really on what does it take to bring people back to work, then we can start thinking about some entrepreneurial ways to create some revenue, a revenue stream. Because look, I think not only is it very, very clear to me that the vast majority of people who have done the right thing and sheltered in place for the purpose of keeping themselves safe and therefore flattening the curve, which is a term I had never heard till probably mid-March or something like that, you can see that that's been working, but people have cabin fever. And as much as people have been enjoying making sourdough bread at home and smoking their own salmon at home and whatever other kind of cooking they're doing, people definitely crave restaurants. And they don't just crave having someone else do your cooking. They crave the social experience of being with friends in an environment that is convivial, where you actually get to see and smell and taste and feel and hear using all five of your senses in a very social kind of way. So we're going to get there. But what we're now thinking about is how can we deliver hospitality to you even outside of the four walls of our restaurants? So if you ask every restaurant in the country today to tell you what are the two top things that they'll be thinking about along those lines, they'll talk about things like, takeout and delivery. And so, great. My question is, for my business, what can we add to the dialogue on those two words? What does delivery mean? Delivery has come to mean something faceless and nameless and highly convenient, which is you make contact between your finger and your smartphone, and voila, food magically appears 45 minutes later. Zero experience, but very, very convenient. And so the kind of things that I think we need to be thinking about in our business are, what if we could use this word delivery to actually mean hospitality? What if delivery, a really wonderful convenience, which, by the way, has not been very profitable for the big delivery companies and also has not at all been profitable for restaurants who have a big chunk of their profit taken out. What if delivery meant hospitality? What if delivery was more akin to the house calls that I remember getting occasionally from my doctor when I was a kid growing up in St. Louis? What if we put our people to work, and instead of thinking about the convenience of being able to deliver a pasta from Maialino, which is in Gramercy Park, you know, 8 zip codes away, what if we thought about our neighborhood? And what if we thought about, instead of more volume, what if we thought about deeper relationships with people who live in our neighborhood? And so the kind of thinking that I'm trying to do right now is to get big by thinking small, or get return to being bigger by beginning by thinking smaller, and thinking about what would it feel like to get a hospitality house call? What would it feel like if you ordered your food from Gramercy Tavern and got the chef on FaceTime and you deepened a relationship, a human relationship, in the same process? What would it feel like if one of our cooks delivered that food with a note from the chef with reheating instructions? What would it feel like if, along with that delivery, came groceries for this week because you trust the farmers we do business with? How would it feel if you knew that you were helping to keep a farmer in business when you did that, who would otherwise have to, you know, throw their produce out because there's no distribution model for it? Those building blocks will get us to the point where we can reopen our restaurants. I will just share, I'm not very excited about some of the things I'm reading about that are taking place in Asia right now, as some of those restaurants reopen, where you take out 50 or 60% of your seats, everybody's wearing a mask, you have plexiglass dividers between every table, you take everybody's temperature on the way in. You know, if you want to open to the public, of course you will have to do those things. But I would prefer to find ways that we can be ourselves in a new model, but then bring you home to the restaurant that you knew in the first place.
Yeah.
It's a longer conversation, but this is a moment of innovate or die. You're right in the middle of it. Other businesses, Tom's, mine, yours, we have to figure that out. One innovation I bet you've thought about, and I love your idea about, a lot of what you talked about was creating a neighborhood or community concept outside the restaurant, because sitting behind plexiglass with masks is not the Gramercy Tavern that any of us remember and love. And it isn't the restaurant experience that you cultivate. Mobile kitchens might be something that's relevant for you. Creating, and I think some of your ideas are great. And I think there's an interesting parallel to the entertainment industry right now, right? They're bundling up recording artists, movie previews, and gaming into this kind of immersive one experience over the internet, where they're delivering a lot of things to you novelly. And that's what you're talking about as well, delivering new things with the food. It's pretty neat. But you got to innovate or you're done.
Absolutely. I think in restaurants across America, you'll see some of these innovative ideas that are in fact midway steps till we get back open. But you'll see some of these things stick, because there will be some ideas where, even after I feel safe going into busy restaurants, just like, you know, it took some people 2 years to feel safe getting on an airplane, even though we had metal detectors. But I believe some of these new ideas are going to stick.
Yeah, look at our use of Zoom isn't going to, you know, this is a new thing that we're all, there's going to be application for Zoom going forward, right? We're not going to stay away from our offices, but we'll stick with more of this probably.
You know, one of the things that I find refreshing about all of this, I just want to acknowledge, there's a lot of bad things going on around us. We all know that. People are sick. People are, you know, frontline workers, the sacrifices they're making. There's f- food issues, access to food, access to money. There's a lot of bad things going on. There are some new things that are going on that are quite beneficial and to me, very refreshing, hopeful. And one of them is I can have conversations with business people and get right to the fact that we're on the edge. I can very quickly say, yeah, we barely made it through March. We think we're good through August. We need to figure out a solution for September and October. Typically, you don't do that because every, you know, we're too proud and we're posturing and we're trying to create a facade. But what I found is, you know, I'm part of this Live Events Alliance. And when you're on the Live Events Alliance calls, there's no one feeling good. Like nobody's thinking like, oh, I got it figured out. We all are in this place of struggle. I love the comradeship. I love the honesty. And I love the, you know, sometimes when you're innovating in these moments, you're doing it under a big veil of stress, which is to say, you know, you're trying to steal from Peter to pay Paul, or you're, again, you're keeping the facade while trying something new. In this case, it's like, it's all out innovation. It's all out. I am going to try the very best thing I possibly can. And what I find is even fierce competitors end up rooting for us, which feels good. Now, I'm sure that's not entirely true. That last piece was a little bit of idealistic. But isn't this unprecedented in that regard, just the spirit of where we are and how people are approaching these things?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. One thing I have always loved about our industry is that, you know, even though it's people will certainly tell you that the restaurant industry is a highly competitive business, but because there's so many restaurants, it actually uniquely has the force of bringing people together. Meaning this, if you were talking about Coke and Pepsi, they're arch rivals because every time you have a Coke, you're not having a Pepsi. But if you're talking about going to a New York restaurant on a Monday night, that doesn't mean you're not going to go to one of the other 26,000 restaurants on Tuesday night and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. And so our community, not only in New York City, but really all throughout the country, has always been pretty tight. No question, though, Tom, this has brought people together. There are restaurant coalitions that have sprung up from this, unlike anything I've ever seen in my entire career. Now, a lot of them are really trying to make sure that Congress hears the voice of this industry because, in fact, because there are so many restaurants, something like 660,000 in America, you don't naturally think about the size of this industry. It's not the kind of thing you can get your mind around, like the airline industry, where there's, you know, three or four major carriers, and the auto industry, same kind of deal. And so I think restaurateurs have done finally a good job of really raising the awareness that this industry, which is the second largest employer in the country, is a massive, massive part of what works or doesn't work in our economy. So when, you know, in my case, sadly, we've laid off 95% of our employees at Union Square Hospitality Group. And you just think about not only the ripple effects of that on the economy, but think about the food that we're not buying. And
yeah.
And that, you know, we serve food on airplanes, no longer. We serve food in ballparks, no longer. We would be catering weddings this very, very weekend. We would be doing graduation events over the next three weekends. And so you take that out of the economy, and you also take restaurants out of the national psyche, where this thing actually feels really good. It feels good to serve people if you work in a restaurant, and it feels good to be served and to be in that social environment. If you go to a restaurant, take that out, and we're a very different society. So I think restaurants have bonded together. Everybody's got a slightly different approach to the kind of help that's needed from the government right now. But at least there's a unified voice saying, please do not leave this industry behind or else.
Danny, one thing we've talked a lot about is this idea of agency, right? So there's consumer agency, there's CEO agency, governor agency, presidential agency. And in your instance, you're talking about trying to increase that self-agency to go back to restaurants. How afraid will we be for how long? Have you and your partners in the restaurant, your previous competitors in the restaurant world, talked about creating a standard that we as consumers can look at and say, you know, this is the Corona standard of safety that we're living to here, and we understand what that means? It would appear to me to be an opportunity for you guys, right? To say, if you got a between you and your competitors, you have such extraordinary brand value. And if you were to communicate to consumers that we've gotten together, we believe the following things, you know, fit OSHA, fit CDC, fit all the professional best, and we're going to bring those forward, you might be able to accelerate part of that reemergence. And part of what's changing now is people are really learning, and in some instances for the first time, that like it's not all up to the government. The government's not going to solve it all for us. So that A in the window in New York City is no longer what I need to see. I need something else.
Yeah, I think you raise a really good point, and you're starting to see that emerge really over the last week or two. It was too soon I think it was too soon for people to wrap their minds around what will it take to make our industry feel safe. And getting back to one of the themes we spoke about earlier, we are all in this together. This tide will either lift or depress all boats. There's not going to be anything in our industry where one boat is here and the rest of the boats are down, or one boat is down and the rest of the boats are up. It's just, I think that there are at least three organizations right now working on a standard safety protocol for reopening. And I think that the big X factor in this whole thing is really, when will there be a vaccine? And this past week has given us hope that may, you know, if you had asked me a week ago today, I would have said, that's a year and a half away from everything I've read. Now, this week, I'm starting to read that there could be an approved vaccine that could be in distribution with 300 million doses available in this country sometime by first quarter of next year. That's massive. That's the type of thing that is more than almost anything else going to shift the psyche to saying it's safe. Before that happens, obviously what we need to do is to be able to test for antibodies and to find out, and I know airlines are dealing with this right now. Airlines are talking about potentially you're needing to have a passport that says that you have antibodies for the virus, so that you're not going to get it and you're not going to give it to somebody. Well, we need that in our industry just to put people back to work. And again, that's what I'm focused on more than anything, is putting people back to work. Because if we can do that safely, I know that we can then start to serve people in safe ways. And each time we do that, each time you have a meal delivered to your home from one of our restaurants, or each time you stand 6 feet away from somebody and pick up a great meal in one of our restaurants, that alone is going to increase your level of confidence in just doing business with us. And then when it's time to open our doors, and again, I'm not excited about greeting you with a Halloween mask. No. I know that that's the safe thing to do, but I'd rather wait a little bit longer. And if the vaccine is accelerated, and if drugs to mitigate the impact of the virus are accelerated and testing is accelerated, this is going to start to come together.
I hope that I'm totally wrong, but having looked at and worked on at least vaccine policy for 20 years in one guise or the other, your numbers, while yes, currently reported, are still probably quite optimistic. We'll see. But it's...
Just don't forget that the root of the word hospitality is hope. So can't help myself.
I would hope that there's a number of solutions that allow us to get to your hospitality before a vaccine emerges.
And when you say that, you're talking sort of treatment and safety, some kind of combo.
there is a testing magic bullet, right? If we can get to on-demand rapid testing, I can walk up to one of your restaurants, take a test outside, get my green light, come on inside, and know that everyone in there is safe. Now, that seems like science fiction, but it's not. No, now, then there's a testing passport for a day or a week.
You know, I'm a very avid apostle for the company called Clear, which we've all seen in airports.
Yeah.
And I like the experience.
Great example.
And Clear knows who I am, and it knows that this is me, and it knows that this is a trusted traveler, but it's capable of knowing anything about me. It's capable of knowing my credit card information because I no longer want to take my credit card out of my wallet. It's capable of knowing whether I have immunity. And that's the kind of application that I would love to see in a restaurant, because it's also capable of knowing that RP's favorite table is 43. And so if we can find ways to let people know that it's safe, but also to add hospitality, that would be a really exciting kind of solution.
Danny, in your restaurants, my favorite table is my wife's favorite table, which is the one closest to Jude Law. That's what I've noticed when we go into your places.
Yeah.
He's a downgrade from you.
You know,
that's what I tell.
I just want to share one statistic, because in all of this, and I'm taking this from you, Danny, and I know this is an approximation, but and we all have these issues. I'm not sure everyone understands the degree to which these issues are very real, which is, in your case, you said 80%. You've got to be 80% full, you know, to break even. My number's a little more it's more flexible, but I won't bore you with that. I share that because these are the realities that people are facing. Like, people can't do 25% of the, long story short, you're better, you'll lose less money keeping the door closed than by opening it up and getting to 60%. So these are the kinds of challenges that people are facing, and these are why these solutions just require so much.
And not many people are talking about that very topic, Tom. Just because you could do something doesn't mean that from a business standpoint, you should.
Yeah. Well, and in the end, it's, you know, so I use the camp analogy again. He said it to me, the head of camp has said, I am willing to lose more by opening the doors because I love my camp and because there's brand issues and other issues that come into play. And to a certain extent, he has the luxury to make that statement. This isn't a guy rolling in money. All I'm trying to say is that he feels like he can lose more money this year by opening than by closing. And that's a decision he'll make. All I wanted to just share is that these kinds of decisions are very difficult. And at some point, these aren't preferences. These are just realities. Because if the money runs out, the money runs out. And that I've been there before. I know what that's like. Very challenging. And really the ultimate
thing we're balancing, it's three things. It's having enough of a financial support system to return to being an excellent employer. It's having all of the safety protocols that connect to every ounce of science there is. And then there's the psychology of fear, human fear. Balance with human safety. And it's really a balancing act between those three things. And then it's furthermore, obviously, a balancing act between, I think, if you're a business, the responsibility you feel towards the people who work for you, and now the responsibility you feel towards the people who once worked for you. We know that as more and more time goes by, people are, you know, if we've laid off over 2,000 people, some of those people are never coming back to New York. Some of those people may never come back to the restaurant industry. But we still feel a responsibility to see that light at the end of the tunnel and say, there will be a day that we will be back open, and we want as many of these awesome people as we possibly can.
Yeah. Well, I love, you know, some of the things you outlined, which you could say the word unimaginable. Unimaginable services, experiences through online order and delivery, like FaceTiming with a chef, for example. So I'm rooting for you there. And I want to say, I'm going to read you just the very end of this letter that we talked about at the beginning. And so this is written by my friend, Sean Moran, who just left Viacom after a year career there of 25 years. And he says, I hope this all wasn't too boring, but we just wanted to let you know how much you and your restaurant have added to our lives. The food is always unbelievable, and the staff is nothing short of fantastic. We'll be there again this year for the 10th anniversary. Thank you for your part in this wonderful tradition. This is written in December of 2003, so the tradition started in 1993. Anyway, I mention it now because I'm glad you, when I was asking you, like, how do you think about opening, and your answer was, I'm starting with thinking about how I keep my people safe. That's the right answer. And that's why these people, because you and your staff have added to our lives. That's why. So I want to acknowledge that. And I want to thank you for the time. RP, I don't know if you have anything else you want to.
I don't. It's a pleasure being with you, Danny. Thanks for all you're doing. And I'm really excited to get back into the cozy confines with a nice old fashioned in my hand and maybe a Chateaubriand or something. So looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you both. I'll just say that letter was touching, and my favorite part of it was when your friend Sean referred to Gramercy Tavern as being your restaurant, because that's what we aim to do. We call it shared ownership. We know that we succeed when someone feels like this is my place. So that felt great.
I'm glad. Danny, thank you.
Thank you both very much.
Good to see everybody. Thank you.